I think it's quite true. When you hear people talk about Christianity, we always tend in America to think of it as an American thing, don't we? Even hear Christians talk about this as though Christianity and being an American are virtually synonymous. Well, they're not, of course. The vast majority of Christians live outside the United States. And really, in terms of, although we are predominantly a nation where, if polled, the population will say that they are Christian, at least nominally Christian, Christianity is more and more becoming a Southern Hemisphere phenomenon here on planet Earth, rather than Northern Hemisphere phenomenon. What about Christianity in Israel, where it all started, the very ground our Savior trod in his incarnation before his death and resurrection and ascension into heaven? The Holy Land. We're going to talk about that in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. today. Our guest joining us here in Studio A, Pastor Torkil Masvi. We're going to be speaking with him. And then in the second half hour, hopefully we'll, and this is going to be a little bit of catch-as-catch-can, Doug Johnson is going to join us from National Right to Life. He's going to bring us up to date on President Bush's signature put today on the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. We'll be hearing not only from Doug, but getting his reaction to several things, including the president's comments and comments of those who have vowed to oppose the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. In the last part of Issues Etc. today, starting at 4:30, we're going to talk about the Magna Carta of the Reformation, the Augsburg Confession. Dr. Martin Nolan will join us here in Studio A. He's director of the Concordia Historical Institute, and we'll be talking about a document penned in the 16th century by Lutherans, but that was picked up by many other streams of the Reformation, sometimes in toto, sometimes simply borrowed from liberally by other reformers, the Augsburg Confession. We'll find out what it's all about and why it has been so very influential since the Reformation. Our call-in numbers today, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Pastor Torkil Masvi is International Director of the Kaspari Center for Biblical and Jewish Studies. Pastor, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
First of all, where does the name Kaspari come from? What is the significance of that?
That was a brilliant Jewish scholar in the 1800s who came to faith in Jesus and became a professor of theology in Northern Europe, actually Oslo, where I had my theological education from. And he was both a brilliant scholar, a Jewish believer in Jesus, who also happened to be passionate about Jewish mission. So when a theological education center for the Messianic movement in Israel got established almost 22 years ago, it was named after him.
Christianity began among the Jews in Jerusalem, the disciples of Jesus Christ, all of them Jews. It began there with the call of Saint Paul. The mission to the Gentiles began. It's not that long afterward that Christianity becomes identified as almost exclusively a Gentile thing. Tell us about the movement back toward a largely Gentile church seeking to do mission among Jewish people.
Well, let me first add some elements to what you describe now. It's what you said now is very much in accordance with the perception we have. However, the early church was much more Jewish than we tend to think. The Kaspari Center is involved now in a research project writing the history of Jewish believers in Jesus. There were Jewish Jesus believers in the midst of the church all the time. Even after the non-Jews outnumbered the Jewish members of the church in the second century, the Jews were still the teachers of the church, the mighty minority. But over the years, and definitely after the Byzantine time, when the Roman Empire became Christian, the picture really changed, and the Jesus-believing Jews were set aside. We had Jewish congregations in the Middle East, Jewish Christian congregations up to about 400. After 400, we can't find them anymore. But what happened is that these Jesus-believing Jews, in the choice between becoming Jews who say no to Jesus and being a part of the synagogue or becoming non-Jewish Christians, they chose to be non-Jewish Christians. So the Arab Christians today have, to some extent, Jewish blood. They are Jewish Christians without the Jewish identity. That was the first part. You then ask how come that the predominantly Gentile churches, non-Jewish churches, are involved in mission to Jews. Mm-hmm. I understand you right. And that is because of a mission revival that happened 200 years ago. The mission revival we had was a general mission revival to the Gentiles. If you look at the history of mission, something happened after the French Revolution. In Europe and North America, other places, a passion to give the gospel to others. And with that came a special focus also on giving the gospel to the Jews. I myself come from Norway, where the first mission to the Gentiles was established in 1844. And then 2 years later, the same people established the first mission to the Jews at the time when the Norwegian constitution was against Jewish people living in Norway. So there wasn't a single Jew in Norway. And but the Christians had the Bible, and they saw the gospel is the power of salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and then for the Gentile. So this is the background for Northern Europe for the involvement in Jewish mission. And you also have today a very strong evangelical churches, a strong passion for bringing the gospel to the Jews.
Tell us about the state of Christianity in Israel today.
Well, we have, until 150 years ago, a very large minority among the Muslims, a large minority of Christians. They were about 90% of the Christians would then be Greek Orthodox, and 10% would be Catholics. Over the last 150 years, very much has changed. A number of the Christians and their descendants have changed affiliation. So the number of Catholic Palestinians has increased, and the number of Greek Orthodox have decreased. At the same time, also you have other Palestinian churches that has grown out with bringing in members from the Orthodox churches. So it has, to a very limited extent, been Muslims who have come to faith in Jesus. It is Lutherans today who used to be Greek Orthodox 2-3 generations ago. If you look at the demographic today, the number of Arab Christians is down to about 2% or less of the total Arab population. So 98% Muslims, 2% Christians, and among the 2% Christians, it's just a tiny minority of them again who are either evangelical or Protestant.
Mm-hmm. What official status does Christianity have, if any, in the state of Israel today? Is it a recognized religion in terms of the free practice of religion?
Yes. We have inherited a system from the Turks where you have a certain part of the life is restricted by the religion you belong to. For example, it doesn't exist civil marriage in Israel. You want to get married, you better belong to a religion, because you can't get married unless you belong somewhere. Mm. And your spouse should belong to the same church or group. The recognized churches from the time of the Turks have the same recognition in the state of Israel today. And if you look at the Palestinian side, the autonomous areas of the Palestinian Authority, they tend to move in the same direction to give the churches the same right as they had before.
So is it safe to say that in the modern state of Israel, although you mentioned when we were talking before we came on the air that Judaism is the official state religion, it is safe to say that the practice of Christianity is permitted and tolerated in Israel today?
Definitely, it's tolerated, and but the whole society is geared around the Jewish traditions. The buses don't run in Jerusalem on the Sabbath, at least in West Jerusalem. East Jerusalem, slightly different. Tel Aviv, no buses. So the laws and regulations are based on the Jewish traditions. But there is a freedom. There is Israel is a democratic state.
And the practice of Christian proselytizing or mission work is something that can be carried out freely as well.
Yes, on the contrary to what very many people believe, mission is legal in Israel. Israel is, up till today, a democratic state with all the basic democratic rights. There are things happening when there is a conflict where certain basic rights are not followed, but you have the right to do mission work. There are some limitations. You cannot evangelize anyone under the age of 18, and you cannot gain members by kind of buying them in by offering goods, money, other things. Up till today, that's the only limitations that are. It doesn't mean that people are happy with mission. It doesn't mean that Israel would give you official visa to come into the country and do mission work. But an Israeli citizen has also the right to share their faith with others, as long as they're above the age of 18.
Now, why the restriction below the age of 18? Is there a rationale that's put forth for that?
It's considered that they are minors, and you're not to kind of lure or trick people under the age of 18 to do things that is considered being bad. I mean, but that's behind this rule, that you don't like people changing religion. If you want to be a democratic state, you have to accept that that can happen. But you're right by asking the question, why not for those under the age of 18? The thought behind here is we don't like it. It's like you have the minimum drinking age here.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like it, but if you are to do it, you have to be old enough to take the consequences yourself.
And those who are Jewish, who are Christians, believers in Jesus Christ in the state of Israel, what kind of numbers are we talking about there?
Well, the Kaspari Center did a survey in 1999, or Kaspari staff did that for a journal, and one came up with a number about 5,000 participants in about 80 congregations. That includes children, and that includes spouses and others who are not Jewish necessarily. We then have, in addition, an unknown number of Russian immigrants who belong to the Russian Orthodox Church and are Jewish background, but they have not organized themselves in any way. We have been in contact with someone in the Greek Orthodox Church who has the job to work with the Russian Jewish immigrants. And according to those numbers, we're talking about some thousands. So it's very hard to come up with the exact numbers.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on Christianity in Israel, feel free to give us a call now at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our guest here in Studio A, as we talk about Christianity in Israel, Pastor Torkil Mazvi. He's International Director of the Kaspari Center for Biblical and Jewish Studies. Recently, we talked with a guest here on the program who pointed out that there are a small but significant number of Christians among the Palestinians, non-Jewish population in Israel. Tell us about that.
Well, as I said, 2% of the Arabs are Christians, and they have very long tradition. Even new churches in the country have long, long historic lines, historic tradition, because of their link back to the early stages of history through the Greek Orthodox Church, where they all come from, if you go some generations back. You, among these Arab Christians, you have a number of evangelical and Protestant Christians, especially in Galilee. And Galilee is a place where a high number of Christians. In addition to on the Palestinian side, you have Jerusalem, Ramallah, and Bethlehem. That's the main places.
And these are places that obviously, I mean, those names ring with our listeners because they are places where some of the most intense conflict between Palestinians and Jews do take place. How do Christians find themselves in the midst of that conflict, whether they be Palestinian Christians or Jewish Christians or Christians of other origins in Israel?
Oh, it's a very sad situation. We have seen the pain in the midst of the community of believers. We see that Arab Christians in Bethlehem are under curfew because various things that have happened. So the Israeli army is closing the city. And who are the soldiers? Well, some few of the many soldiers are Jesus-believing Jews who are actually guarding outside the homes of Christian relatives or their Christian friends, which is very, very painful. What happened sometimes during this, especially about with Bethlehem, the Christians called to Messianic friends to ask for prayers and help, and the Messianic Jewish community helped bringing in food and other things they needed in order to survive.
Is there a fellowship, an outside fellowship between Jewish Christians and Palestinian Christians, given the fact that the political tensions there are so high?
Well, we have a fellowship of Christian students in the Christian student movement, where Messianic Jewish and Arab Christian students are together in a student movement in Israel. You also have a very important other ministry called the Musalaha, that is a reconciliation ministry between Messianic Jews and Arab Christians, where they have prayer conferences and they do different activities in order to strengthen the relationship between the two sides. So, yes, it exists.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Willis is calling from Perryville. Willis, welcome to Issues, Etc.
I wonder how many Lutherans there are in Israel and how many Lutheran churches. I know there's a church in Bethlehem, Nazareth, and Jerusalem.
Thank you very much. That's a good question, Willis. How many Lutherans in Israel?
Well, in Israel proper, it's hard to say if there's any. If we say that, if we say Israel before 67, mm-hmm. the Lutheran Church in this region is official name is the Lutheran Church in Jordan. They have five congregations: one in Jerusalem in the Old City, one in Ramallah, two in the Bethlehem area, and one in Amman in today's Jordan. So. If we are to be political correct, we would say that of the five congregations, one is in Jordan and four in the Palestinian state.
And therefore, in Israel today, you'd say none because of the way the borders are drawn.
Well, if one accepts the Israel's sovereignty over the Old City, there is one. Okay, but we enter a difficult. Land here because people have different opinions where should these pieces of land belong to. If the answer to the number is it's about 2,000 altogether in these four congregations. That's the official number I've heard some time ago. The numbers generally of Jesus believing Arabs is going down year by year because of people leaving the country.
Now their leaving is among the Christian Arabs, is Islam having, is it growing among them? Is it finding proselytes among the Christians? In other words, are people leaving the Christian faith to become Muslim?
I don't have exact numbers here, so I cannot say how much effect each different thing have. I mean, do Christians become Muslims? Well, we know that Arafat's wife is Christian or comes from a Christian family. We have some of these issues with mixed marriages where the pressure from the Muslim side is very strong that the kids then will have to become Muslim. My understanding is that there is also some really unhappiness among the Christians for what's happening on the Muslim side. There is saying in the Muslim side that after Sabbath comes Sunday, the meaning first we take the Jews and then we'll take the Christians. Mm. That's about among the extremes. I've never heard that this is kind of represents the center of the Islam there, but nevertheless, it's the extremes that set the agenda very often. But the most important reason I am aware of is that life is difficult. The Christians have higher education, fewer kids, and higher expectation of life. And they have already a number of relatives overseas, Australia, North America, South America, And they want to give their kids a better future, and they leave the country, and they have means to leave, and they have means to get reestablished somewhere else also.
Give us a picture of the countries surrounding Israel today. We've talked about the picture inside, but of those bordering the state of Israel today, are there Christian populations in those largely Muslim countries?
Oh, definitely. If my memory serves me right, I think we're talking up to 10% in Egypt of Coptic. In Jordan, I'm not aware of the number, but there must be quite a group. I think it must be far less than 10%, but anyway. Then we have a Christian minority in Syria, and Lebanon used to have a Christian majority until the birth rate among the Muslims outnumbered the Christians, so they today are in a majority, the Muslims there. So they are surrounded by Christians.
In your attempts through the Kasfari Center to evangelize Jews there in Israel and to bring the message of the gospel there, do you find that you have allies in those other nations among the Christians who are willing to help?
I think where we are now, this is not an issue whether that you can help or not. The kind of the conflict is so strong. So I think, and I know there are Arab Christians who are very happy that Jewish people are coming to faith in Jesus, but they are not a partner for us. What we do as a center, we're an educational center, so we work more indirectly to equip the Jesus-believing Jews for them to be active and help the growth of their fellowships and community.
So generally speaking, before we go to this break, and I'd like you to stay, if you would, for a few minutes after this break. Is that all right?
That's fine.
Generally speaking, in terms of the percentage of population in the state of Israel today, is the percentage of Christians in the population rising or is it falling?
If the number of believers
yes.
is rising,
mm-hmm.
On the Jewish side, it's increasing. On the Arab side, decreasing.
We're talking with Pastor Torkil Mazvi. He's International Director for the Kasfari Center for Biblical and Jewish Studies. When we come back, what is the biggest challenge facing those who would bring the gospel of Jesus Christ to Arabs and to Jews in the state of Israel today? Obviously, we've mentioned one of them, and that is the conflict. This political, the social conflict, seems almost insurmountable. But there are other challenges, and we'll talk about them when we come back from this break. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If you have a question or a comment on Christianity in Israel, Pastor Torkil Mazvi will be our guest for about another 10 minutes after this break. A little later in the hour, we'll be talking with Doug Johnson from National Right to Life. President Bush put his signature on the partial birth abortion ban today. He had some things to say, some very strong things to say, and the opponents of this ban are also saying a few things as well. We'll get the reaction from Doug Johnson on that. And then, in the latter part of the program, do not forget and please stay tuned, because we're going to be talking about the Magna Carta of the Reformation, that document that, if you will, was the first official statement on the part of the Reformers. It's called the Augsburg Confession. We will find out why it came about and what it has to say. Dr. Martin Nolan will be our guest. We'll be right back.
Message first. Mission second. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Have you grown weary of devotional books that focus more upon the Christian than upon Christ? Devotions emphasizing Christ in you more than Christ for you. Issues, Etc. recommends Meditations on Divine Mercy by Johann Gerhard. It's our book of the month for November. Meditations on Divine Mercy is translated by Issues, Etc. regular guest Pastor Matt Harrison. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information on this book, or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. If you've read the Prayer of Jabez, you need Meditations on Divine Mercy. 1-800-325-3040. Or issuesetc.org. Meditations on Divine Mercy, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for November. That's 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on children in Bolivia who don't have homes, but there's a place helping them cross from despair into hope. In the Bolivian city of Santa Cruz, there's a large population of children who live on the streets. Their families abuse them, or they couldn't feed them. Local Christians in Santa Cruz work with the Gospel Missionary Union to host Bible studies, teach job skills like computers, baking, and sewing. The ministry is known as Al Jordan, and it also develops the kids into disciples for Jesus Christ. Gospel Missionary Union has short-term missionaries and long-term missionaries with a variety of skills. The program helping street kids in Bolivia is also in partnership with local Bolivian churches and other children's ministries. Pray for street kids in Santa Cruz to discover Christ's love. Get involved in a significant ministry. Log on to www.gmu.org. That's gmu.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Yesterday, in many areas of the country, the voters had their say. In my own faith tradition, it's not a bishop, but the local congregation that elects its minister. And after Reverend so-and-so has been elected, a vote is taken to make his selection, his call, unanimous. The reason for that is that the minister will then know he will have 100% support as he comes in to do the Lord's work in that place. Now, such a practice isn't for secular elections, obviously. There's so much transparent partisanship in politics that we would be fools to think that everyone is going to start working together the day after the election. That said, God still asks 100% of his people to pray for the election winners, even if you do think the voters were stupid. 1 Timothy 2, I urge that requests, prayers, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings and all those in authority. These little minutes are read all over our nation, including Washington, D.C. To you elected officials, Meyer Minute men and Meyer Minute women are praying for you. And when you give your mandatory partisan speeches, remember to pray for those who don't have your insight. God help us all. I'm Dale Meyer.
When Pastor John Lukomsky was little Johnny Lukomsky, he watched Saturday morning cartoons. But now that he's a mature adult, he plays on the radio. Hi, this is Paul Clayton. You've got to hear Wrestling with the Basics with Pastor Jolly John Lukomsky. It's kind of a fun approach to a Bible study. We guarantee you will learn something and take something with you from Wrestling with the Basics, Saturday mornings at 9:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Torkild Mosvi is our guest. We're talking about Christianity in Israel. Again, if you have a question or a comment, he'll be with us for about another 10 minutes, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. After that, I misspoke before the break. Patricia Call will be our guest, Congressional Liaison for National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C. We'll be talking about President Bush's signing of the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act in just a few minutes. Pastor Mosvi, what is the biggest challenge beyond the social and political conflict that is so rife in Israel in doing missions, Christian missions, among the Jews and the Arabs there in Israel?
I think the Christian history is an obstacle for mission to both groups. If we look at to the Arab side, we have the history of the Crusaders, which is a very tragic history. The Crusaders were very rude, didn't behave. They even robbed the other Christians on their way. So it was really a mob. Most people groups have a tremendous memory of evil things other have done to them. We probably have the same. We just don't remember our own bad things. So when we do have preaching, we might even call it a crusade, not knowing what kind of feelings it generates with others.
And when they hear that, they immediately have very strong memories and recollections.
Right. On the Jewish side, it's the same. The Christian anti-Semitic history is very painful. After the Byzantine time after the empire became Christian, the Roman Empire, we didn't handle power very well, and we have treated the Jewish side terribly, and that works against the Christian testimony now. The cross is giving the same feelings to Jews as the Swastika, the Nazi Swastika, would do to us, because the pogroms were done in Eastern Europe in Easter times, where the priest would go in the front of the whole group and the mob follow after, and they enter Jewish homes and burnt and killed and raped and terrible, and wanted to punish the Jews because they killed Jesus, as they would say.
So how does the average Jew in Israel look at a Christian? What would be his stereotype, if you will, of the Christian?
The very many of the kind of anti-Semitic images of Christians are still there. New examples of anti-Semitism by many is considered a way to confirm that this is still active and valid. I myself did a course in modern Hebrew in Israel 12 years ago, and the Russian immigrants, some Russian immigrants in my group, had heard from the Russian Orthodox priest in their hometown that Hitler was a bad guy. The only good thing he did was he tried to kill the Jews. I mean, in case this sentence is said about 13, 14 years ago, and it had the Jewish people in my Hebrew class think that, well, it shows nothing has changed. So that's one of the elements of the way to see Christianity. But on the other hand, in the conflict with the Muslims, they also understand that Christian countries are more supporting than what is the average in the world. And North America, with a very strong Christian presence, is standing behind and helping Israel. So many don't know really how to think about Christians.
Most people in America, especially among evangelical Christians, will view a visit to the Holy Land as kind of a tourist destination. Mm. But for the Jewish Christians who live over there, this is their home. What is the perception of the influx of tourism from the United States and elsewhere, particularly among evangelical Christians, into Israel? How do they perceive that?
Well, the what you call Jewish Christians, or Messianic Jews, mm-hmm. as they
yes.
would call themselves, they would have a mixed feeling about the tourists, because the tourists go to different places. Some tourists only visit Messianic congregations, and they're happy to have the visit and feel the support and also be able to partner with them in different projects. Well, then you have other churches that only visit the Palestinian Christians and don't include a visit to the Jesus-believing Jews at all. So what is missing here in all cases is that the tours include an encounter not only with the stones, but with the living stones, the Jesus believers there today, that are really both Jews and Arabs. And that's what I would love to see, groups going to that part of the world and include an encounter with both Arab Christians and Messianic Jews.
President George W. Bush has made, from the very beginning of his administration, he has made it very clear that he would like to see the establishment of a Palestinian state, a free democratic Palestinian state, alongside the state of Israel. Now, obviously, there are a lot of details there. In particular, where do you draw the borders? If that ever were to occur, and there were relative peace there in that part of the country, would that how much would that change the efforts to bring the gospel to people there?
I don't know, because on one hand, the conflict is an obstacle to do the work. On the other hand, it brings opportunities. People see that it's hard to make peace, but they're still seeking for the peace in their hearts. So I don't know really if it will get easier or more difficult if there is a peace in the country. I really wish there will be a peace. For the sake of the kids there, I want it to be peaceful.
I suppose since this is much in the news, we also, since you have an insight into this, what is the popular view of the United States activity in Iraq, in Israel today? How is that generally viewed?
My understanding is that Israelis feel that Americans are in the same kind of trouble that they are themselves. And the world has condemned Israel for being tough and dealing with terror when it's close to them, and they have the suicide bombers and all that. And Israel feels that they are perhaps the only ones in the world who understands the Americans fully. And of course, they were very happy that that they took out Saddam Hussein. On the other hand, Israelis are even more concerned with Iran, the nuclear power and the nuclear abilities and war abilities of and launch missiles with nuclear warheads is a bigger threat from Iran than Iraq.
Pastor Torkil Mazvi, thank you very much for being our guest, and thank you for staying the extra few minutes with us here on Issues, Etc.
It's a pleasure.
Pastor Torkil Mazvi is International Director of the Kaspari Center for Biblical and Jewish Studies. You can check out their website. It's www.kaspari.com. I'll spell that out. It's C-A-S-P-A-R-I.com, Kaspari.com. Or you can contact their office in Carroll Stream, Illinois, at area code 630-668-3328. That's 630-668-3328.
Today, at last, the American people and our government have confronted the violence and come to the defense of the innocent child.
That was President George W. Bush today as he signed the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. He is speaking in strong terms, obviously, to an approving audience, although not everyone is approving. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking with Patricia Call. She's Congressional Liaison for National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C. They're having a very busy day, I imagine. And we're going to find out what exactly this ban brings about and get her reaction to some of the opposition to the ban. I guess we could say it goes without saying this is far from over. Patricia Call, thank you very much for being our guest, and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be with you.
Tell us what happened today.
Well, we were very pleased that President Bush signed the ban on partial birth abortions. We expected nothing less. He has been a friend to mothers and their children, as you are aware. He believes, along with 70% of the public, that no abortionist should have the right to mostly deliver a premature 5 to 6 month old unborn child feet first, keeping the head inside the mother just so that he can stab that child in the back of her neck and suction out her brains.
Patricia, I'd like you to react to something else that President Bush had to say today at the signing.
The executive branch will vigorously defend this law against any who would try to overturn it in the courts.
Patricia, your reaction to President Bush's words there?
Well, we are just so gratified to know that he has been such an advocate for these unborn children and their mothers. You know, this is a gruesome procedure which hurts women and is deadly to children. You know, and you know that already a federal district judge in Nebraska has issued a temporary order to prevent the law from being enforced. So what does that mean? That means that tomorrow, partly born premature infants will die at the point of a 7-inch scissors simply because of one federal judge's order. So we are definitely grateful for President Bush's support of the ban and his work to make sure that children are spared this kind of horrible death.
There have also been some lawsuits, I believe, filed in various areas of the country by major pro-choice organizations against this ban. Tell us about those.
Yes, well, what they intend to do is they want to make sure that the ban on partial birth abortions doesn't see the light of day, and they're banking on the fact that in the year 2000, five justices of the Supreme Court struck down a similar ban, the Nebraska state ban on partial birth abortions, saying, and the Supreme Court did this partly saying because that they were concerned it would cover also a more common method, the dilation and evacuation D&E, in which an abortionist may pull one of the baby's limbs into the birth canal while he is dismembering that child inside the mother's womb. So what pro-abortion organizations are saying is that the ban on partial birth abortion is going to restrict other types of abortion. We say that's ridiculous. The bill is perfectly crafted. It's very explicit. We're just focusing on one particular kind of abortion, the partial birth abortion.
Now, here's Congressman Louise Slaughter, co-chair for the Congressional Pro-Choice Caucus. She's vowed to fight this new law in the courts.
We will not give this up easily. We know that the court has done right in the past, and we are calling on them today, the two suits that are working their way now through the courts to them, that they will make the same judgments that they have made before, because there is simply no difference in this bill and the ones they've already found unconstitutional.
Patricia, is the Congresswoman right here? She seems to say that there is no difference between this bill. What's your reaction and the ones that have been knocked down by the courts before?
Well, I would say she hasn't read the new bill. The federal bill just signed into law by President Bush has a very strict definition. It bans an abortion in which the abortionist delivers a baby feet first past the navel outside of the mother. So that's past the belly button, keeping the head inside of the mother, and then the abortionist kills the baby by jabbing the scissors in the back of the head. You know, it couldn't be more specific if we tried. These abortions are generally performed in the 5th and 6th months of pregnancy on perfectly healthy babies of perfectly healthy mothers. Now, in 2000, she's referring to the Supreme Court case in 2000 in which the five Supreme Court justices said that Roe v. Wade guarantees the right to perform partial birth abortions at will. And, you know, of course, we can't tell what the court will do now. You know, we do believe that the bill responds to those concerns of the court in 2000. But the bottom line is we do hope that there will be at least one vote shift away from that extreme and inhumane position in defense of this horrible, cruel procedure, you know, that is just indefensible.
Do you have any idea where that one vote shift might occur?
We're not, you know, that's anybody's guess. You know, that could come in the form of a change of heart on the part of one of the justices that supported striking down or the ban on the Nebraska ban in 2000. It could come in the form of a new justice. You know, it's kind of up in the air as to how it will happen, but we certainly hope that they will look to the American public, you know, and see that 70% of the public believes that we should ban this horrific procedure. 3/4 of the Congress have done so. The president is behind banning this procedure. And this is out of the medical mainstream community. This is a procedure which only rogue abortionists do.
I'd also like your reaction to something else the Congresswoman Louise Slaughter had to say today.
This is a very, very dangerous precedent. If we can outlaw this procedure simply by an act of Congress, ask yourself what's next. Could Congress decide that no woman can have a hysterectomy during her childbearing years? Think about it. Do you want the members of Congress to be making those decisions for you?
Patricia, your reaction to her equation of the hysterectomy with partial birth abortion?
That's absolutely ridiculous. The bill specifically would ban one procedure, the partial birth abortion ban. It's not the hysterectomy ban. You know, and in terms of protecting a woman's health and decisions about her health, you know, the bill encompasses congressional findings that summarize testimony of the last 8 years, which indicate that partial birth abortion is never medically indicated and actually poses substantial risks to the mother's health. You know, if we think about it, why would pulling a premature baby out of her mother's womb and body and then stabbing her in the back of the head do any good or be healthy for women at all? You know, we have to keep in mind, of course, according to the National Coalition of Abortion Providers, these are the people who are representing abortion clinics out there, that most of these are done on perfectly healthy babies of perfectly healthy mothers in the 5th and 6th months of pregnancy. Indeed, you know, even at one abortion clinic in New Jersey, two abortionists there said that they did 1,500 partial birth abortions every year, and the women getting them were getting them for the same reasons as they get other abortions, namely social reasons. These are not women in dire medical emergencies, as Congresswoman Slaughter would suggest or others in the pro-abortion camp. These are women who didn't know or didn't care how far along they were. But in regards to those situations, those rare cases in which, for instance, in the seventh month and later, where there is some medical problem with the mother or the baby, you know, a real doctor delivers the baby without stabbing her in the back of the skull and then does what he can for both patients. So the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act is good for women, is good for women's health, and absolutely good for the protection of innocent unborn life.
Representative Slaughter seems to be blurring definitions. Is this typical of pro-choice rhetoric?
Absolutely, because they are so determined not to recognize any unborn child at any point in pregnancy from any particular horrific procedure. They'll say and do anything contrary to the truth. You know, we are relying, when we say that these partial birth abortions are done on perfectly healthy babies of perfectly healthy mothers, we are relying on the testimony of abortionists. This is what abortionists say, and that, you know, that Louise Slaughter and others would suggest otherwise, that these are only done in emergency situations. They're obscuring the truth.
What does it tell you? That when any limit is either proposed or, in this case, passed against abortion, and this only the most horrific form of abortion, the pro-choice side talks as though Roe v. Wade has been overturned altogether.
Yes, and that's ridiculous. There are currently 6 Supreme Court justices sitting on the court who are in favor of Roe v. Wade, and 3 opposed. Now, in the year 2000, the Supreme Court, only five Supreme Court justices said that Roe v. Wade equals partial birth abortions. Louise Slaughter is being hyperbolic and untruthful.
Finally, Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney, she says this ban is going to hurt women.
The question is not whether the bill is unconstitutional, which it clearly is. The question, Mr. President, is why are you signing into law an unconstitutional law that is harmful to the health of our sisters, our daughters, our mothers, our friends?
How do you respond, Patricia?
Well, I would say that, as I said, you know, there's nothing about pulling a premature 5 to 6 month old unborn child from his or her mother simply to stab that child in the back of the neck that's good for women. There is nothing medically necessary about that procedure. If for some reason, as I said, in the later stages of pregnancy, there's some medical issue, the point is to separate the unborn child from the mother and then do what you can for both patients. There's no situation in which that requires a dead baby, to be perfectly clear. And on top of that, the partial birth procedure actually involves substantial other risks. To say that banning partial birth abortion is not good for women's health is absolutely untruthful.
So, in other words, when the objection is raised, okay, there's no health exception in this bill, therefore it's a bogus bill, you are saying the very nature of partial birth abortion, that procedure itself, the very nature that the baby is delivered almost entirely before it is killed in this heinous method, demonstrates that a woman who could be a candidate for this type of abortion procedure is not going to be harmed by carrying the child to full term and giving birth to a live child.
Absolutely. You know, that child is mere inches away from complete birth. And if that child, that 5 or 6 month old unborn child, is expelled by premature labor, otherwise, that child would gasp and exhibit signs of life. That child would be considered a person under the law. That child would be a live birth. So the fact that the abortionist holds the baby's head inside the mother, That's what the abortionist is doing. He's holding the head inside of the mother in order to make it an abortion. If he lifted those fingers and that baby's head slipped out, he'd have a live-born child to deal with. So, yeah.
Do you think that the mind of the nation, of the populace, is changing on this issue in particular? Is that reflected in the passage and signature on this bill?
Absolutely. Pro-life, as well as people who consider themselves pro-choice, supported this bill in Congress. Three-quarters of the Congress passed the bill. And it passed twice before in Congress, only for the bill to meet its death by the hands of President Clinton in a veto ceremony. So there is definitely a shift in the pro-life direction. Medical economics produced a poll recently indicating that 57% of OBGYNs supported a ban on partial birth abortion. And RN Magazine did a similar poll and discovered that two-thirds of nurses, registered nurses, supported a ban on partial birth abortion. This is contrary to what pro-abortion folks have been saying. You know, it's clear that people are starting to recognize that there are two lives here involved in these decisions.
So you've been fighting for 10 years to get this ban passed, and now it has a signature. Does that mean you take some time off, relax, and celebrate this victory?
Well, there was a nice little lunch in our conference room this afternoon, but already, you know, we have been responding to calls about the fight coming up in the Supreme Court. So there'll be a moment to breathe, but the fight continues for sure.
Patricia Call, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Keep up the good work. Patricia Call, Congressional Liaison for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. Now, if you'd like to visit National Right to Life on the web, go to their website, nrlc.org. That's www.nrlc.org. When we come back, some other people are chiming in on the president's signature. I'd like to respond to some of the statements made by one Reverend Carlton Veazey. He's president of Religious Coalition for Choice. He's got some things to say about why he believes from a religious perspective this is a bad move. I'll react to that, and I'd like your reaction as well. We'll be taking your phone calls in the next half hour after this break at 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Patricia has it right. This is a cause for celebration. But it does not mean, by any stretch of the imagination, that our task is done. For two reasons. One, all that has been done here is the banning of the most heinous form of abortion that man has yet conceived of. Roe v. Wade still stands, and other abortions are still perfectly legal. And, well, the president's signature is not dry and people are already challenging it. This thing still has to pass through the Supreme Court. We'll be right back to take your phone calls and to hear from Reverend Veazey on this issue.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.